This is our 53rd week, if I can get this to work. It's not. I'm telling you, it's been a week for this kind of stuff, hasn't it? Here we go. Okay, so this is our 53rd week. The reading was a little bit lighter, more than average. This week, page 739, 754. We're going to get an introduction, of course, to Daniel in the first four chapters. A lot of material from Jeremiah, the bulk of the reading this week. However, the bulk of that reading, by this time, is sounding very, very familiar. So we're going to spend most all of our time tonight in the book of Daniel, a profoundly important book in the midst of all the prophets, one of the grandest and certainly most impressive foretellings of the future that you'll find among the many such prophecies that are in your Bible. It is therefore one of the grandest, I think, and certainly most absolutely unanswerable arguments in favor of both the existence of God, of the accuracy of these scriptures, that these scriptures were designed and produced by God and not by man. In fact, you may have read some of the editor's comments on the side margins there, that what Daniel does in this book is, for the poor atheist or the skeptic, you know, so utterly unanswerable that what they have resorted to throughout the years is just to say, well, since we believe it's impossible for Daniel to do what he did, then he must be lying about who he was and when he was, and it must be somebody who wrote the book years after these events took place and then lied about it and said, you know, now that he's lived after the fact, he's just talking about history and claiming that he's writing before. That's pathetic. And when you got to resort to that, and anybody that has spent 10 minutes thinking about how we got the Bible, you know, knows that you can see where the book came from. We have powerful and answerable evidence with regard to its construction, and so it's just sad when you reveal a heart that just says, I'm not going to believe it, I will not believe it, no matter what, you know, and so I'm just desperate to come up with a frailest excuse. So, you know, maybe the book was written after the fact, and that's why it's so accurate. Not the case. It was written prior, and certainly tells the future in such minute details. We'll see a little bit in that second chapter, particularly tonight, that it is truly amazing. Before we get into that, though, this will be the last time, I think, that I'll be showing you this chart. We have spent months now looking at a period of time from 930, when who died? Solomon died in 930 B.C. What was his son's name who took over the kingdom? Rehoboam. Rehoboam, wise man or fool? He was a fool, so he immediately accepted the young men's advice instead of the older. Sure proof of foolishness. And so then, who revolted against this and became a king? Jeroboam the first, who was the son of? Nebat. You guys are hot tonight. Okay. So, he leads 10 tribes, north or south, 10 northern tribes. He takes off, and he begins to rule over them, and immediately sets up two idols. Those idols are on the far northern border and the far southern border, in fact, not very many miles from Jerusalem at all. And there in Dan and Bethel, he has bracketed his people so that if they still want to claim to be worshiping Yahweh, they can get to, you know, an altar and take care of their sacrifices without going to Jerusalem, because Jerusalem is God's chosen capital, and there are two tribes down there. Which two tribes are they? That is correct. Those two tribes, Judah and Benjamin, decided, you know, that they would stay under Rehoboam, and so at least there is a nominal worship of Yahweh that's taking place there in Jerusalem. So we then went through a two-sided chart to begin with. It shows parallel columns what we had going on in Israel, the 10 tribes in the north, in Judah, which are now jointly called that, in the south. But in what year had God finally had it with the northern 10 tribes, who never had a good king? Every one of them was idolatrous. What happened in what year? 722, who came in? Assyria. Sennacherib and some others, actually. And in 722, the northern 10 kingdoms are demolished. They're taken off into captivity. Very few stragglers, you know, running around. But
That's the end of this. So we shifted over to the right-hand side of what was the chart before. We had only Judah remaining now after 722 BC, but we've worked our way all the way down to the Babylonian captivity. We are now in the material where Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, has come into his power, and he's going to be growing massively and very rapidly for the next few years. This man, Nebuchadnezzar, first attacks Judah and Jerusalem, his capital, in what year? 606. He'll come back again because they wouldn't fully submit in what year? 597. He'll come back a third time and make good on all of his threats in what year? 586 B.C. Jeremiah in chapter 25 says that they'll be in captivity for 70 years. When should we start the clock ticking? 606 and 586, because as the history unfolds, exactly 70 years after the initial invasion, when who was taken captive? Daniel, the book we'll be starting to read tonight. Exactly in 606, you start the clock there, then the Medes and Persians will conquer Babylon and give the edict that the Jews may return, and so they will. There's a 70-year captivity there, but Nebuchadnezzar didn't destroy the temple until what year? 586. If you start the clock there, and we start building the temple 70 years later, what year would we be in? 516 B.C., and lo and behold, that's exactly what happened. And so those are the dates that I have been using, and as a result there then, this chart doesn't even show Daniel, does it? Got Ezekiel in here a little bit, and the back of Obadiah, but you know, there's no Daniel or any other prophets, many of the other prophets, you know, after this point. So we need to have a new chart. Frankly, I haven't settled on one that I really want to use, as sort of a standard. So I'm going to show you a couple here this morning. Those of you that have the New American Standard, I guess you can bring mine tonight. My regular study Bible is the New American Standard Bible. And this is a fold-out double page that they have in that particular Bible. It is excellent. It's particularly excellent if you've done the reading this week, because as we zoom into the area that's inside that square right there, it supports my dating for those three invasions instead of the ones that are being proposed in the book you're reading. There is, as you've been reading, some disagreements about the exact date when a certain event takes place, when a Gentile king, for instance. And so we've got some issues there. There were several blocks that talked about that. We're going to do so in a minute, too. But as you can see, here they've got 605 for Daniel and his friends being taken captive. Here's the same 597 for Ezekiel and 10,000 others. Three stages of captivity, 70-year Jewish captivity. This is the destruction of Jerusalem that they've got in 586. So, this is the one book you've been reading, the Chronological Study Bible, but the dating system that I've been imposing on you is one that is very standard as well. So there's very little leeway, really. It's just almost exactly precise, but nonetheless, some, so I'm sticking with this one. That's my story, now I'm sticking to it. But this also is a chart that's in my Bible. And I really love the new Inductive Study Bible. I have just promoted this thing vigorously. It is just a marvelous work, my favorite Bible. The New American Standard Translation, to begin with, is a strong point, but got some charts that are woven into the books, kind of like the Chronological Study Bible does, that they're just terrific, and especially when it comes to these timelines. They do, really great work with that, particularly because when you zoom in on the chart to right here, you'll discover that once more we have these dates. Jeremiah preaches for about 53 years, 627, 574. Ezekiel's in there too. We get to him in just a minute. Here's Daniel, 606. They say 605 when Daniel and his friends are taken captive. 597, Ezekiel and the 10,000, 586. So, I know, it's the same Bible, but this one now is right there in the book of Daniel. So you don't have to go looking for it at the front of the book like the previous one that I was showing you. But nonetheless, those are the dates that we're going to work with. There can be a year or two either way, but in the end, it's still 70 years. And so,
let's move on into the material itself. And just this mention of Nebuchadnezzar, you saw the slide last week. That guy matters. He's in 8 different books. There are 91 times in the Old Testament that Nebuchadnezzar is the central figure. And so that is a mightily important individual. And oddly enough, he's not a Jew. He's not a part of God's chosen kingdom. He's not one of their kings. He is their destroyer. But he is significant. So many prophets revolve around his times and his rule that God really wanted us to know about him. So, especially tonight, we're going to learn the most about him. Daniel gives us more insight than any other book. And so, we're going to start tonight with a transition, though, on page 740, as we get some introductory material about this man, Daniel, and his meeting King Nebuchadnezzar, along with the 3 friends, all of whose names are changed to satisfy the whims and to honor the God of Nebuchadnezzar. But if you will turn, please, to page 700, let me get over there myself, and 40. We're going to read quite a bit, though not all, of this left-hand column, which is actually a continuation of the transition that was entitled the Book of Daniel from the previous page. But starting here with the second paragraph, which is, that's the first paragraph on the page, second one in the transition. But on page 740 at the top left, the Book of Daniel presents many difficulties to chronological arrangement. To begin with, Daniel 1:1 places Nebuchadnezzar's siege and the beginning of Daniel's exile in the 3rd year of the reign of Jehoiakim, which would be what year? They put it in parenthesis. 605 B.C. But then they say, and this is what I wanted to point out, no other text describes a siege and captivity in that year, which was Nebuchadnezzar's first year. To resolve the difficulty, some scholars favor an otherwise unknown siege in 605 B.C. when it is suggested Nebuchadnezzar sent Chaldean or Babylonian, they're also called, armies against Judah. 2 Kings 24 talks about it. Bound Jehoiakim in chains, carried off vessels from the Jerusalem temple. 2 Chronicles 36 talks about that, along with Daniel and the other exiles. Then another final siege in 597 led to the much larger deportation described in other biblical accounts. Now, I want you to go back there. You know, be the end, tail end there of the 5th line. No other text describes a siege and captivity in that year, which was Nebuchadnezzar's first year. To resolve the difficulty, so I ask you, when the Bible only tells you something once, what's the difficulty? There's no difficulty. How many times does God have to tell you something to make it true? He only has to tell you once. So, how many thousands of things, maybe 10,000 things, do you have in the Bible that you're only told once? Is that a problem? In the harmony of the Gospels, what have you been learning? Because it's right there on the page in 4 columns. How many times does only one Gospel writer tell you about some of the most significant events in Jesus' life? Amazing miracles, marvelous sermons. How many times do you see that? Which is constantly. Terrible problem. How are we going to resolve that? There's no problem at all. And so it just kind of bugs me here. But what they're saying is, and that's fine in this sense, scholars argue about it. Scholars imagine that this is a problem. See, a lot of scholars, brethren, are not even biblical believers. That's the fact. They're very interested in this literature. They make a lifetime out of this literature. That doesn't mean that they're believers in this literature. And so this Bible account, brethren, is all the Bible account I need to know what? Nebuchadnezzar invaded 605 then B.C. That is an established fact, and I know it because what? God said so. It's right there on the page. And it doesn't become right as soon as I find a second passage or a third passage. It's already correct. So, as I've said, it was not God's purpose to write the world's history book. It was his purpose
to teach us about our responsibilities in the world, wherever we live and whenever we live. Everything that is ever said in this book of historical nature is true, whether or not it is verified by another Bible writer or any other writer or archaeology or anything else. And so there's never been found a conflict, and the lack of some supporting information somewhere else is not a problem. It's not a conflict. It's not a mistake. It's still just a fact. So I wanted to harp on that for a while. You can see that I did. Right. So now, skip the next paragraph, and let's go to the third paragraph there that begins with, "It is difficult." It is difficult to imagine why both Kings and Jeremiah neglect to mention such an important event as an invasion and deportation. Well, they're still talking about 605 and the problem of Daniel being the only one that told us about it. But let's read that sentence again. It is difficult to imagine why both Kings and Jeremiah neglect to mention such an important event as an invasion and deportation.
My immediate response to that is, this poor person hasn't hardly got any imagination at all. That's just tragic to be that lacking in brain cells. Now, let me just suggest to begin with, the reason these other two writers didn't tell us about it is because Daniel did! And they didn't need to tell us again. Okay? That's all the problem. And so that's why we don't have any more in Jeremiah or anywhere else, because Daniel did it. Secondly, I'd suggest to you that we don't have a verifying or supporting passage anywhere else because God didn't think it necessary. He didn't want to give us one. We didn't need it. So once again, I'm just helping you be alert, to where these editors are kind of trying to walk on both sides of the fence with your less, faithful Bible students, trying to kind of give credence to everybody. Well, I'm pretty at war with what he's suggesting right here, because he's casting doubt on Daniel. And he can't imagine why Jeremiah and Kings never said it. He thinks that Daniel saying it by himself is a problem. Then what is he saying about Daniel? He doesn't trust it. He doesn't believe it. Well, I do. To quote from Steve Martin, "Well, excuse me." Brethren, it's the truth. And so it's not a problem in any way, shape, or form. Now, I just want you to make a page number note in the last couple of words in the preceding paragraph. So at the end of the second paragraph there, and in the third line from the bottom, starting at the end, it says, "See various deportations to Babylon at Jeremiah 52:28. Grab your trusty pencil, because what they did not do, since we are rearranging the Bible in a chronological order, is give you the page number, which I looked up for you. So in the margin right there, just put page 838. And yes, I would highly recommend that you go read that. I did in preparation for the class. It's helpful. It talks about some of these same things. That'll be on page 838, this various deportations to Babylon is discussed again over there. Now then, let's turn in the same column to the next to last paragraph there. Begins with a second chronological difficulty. A second chronological difficulty has to do with identifying the times referred to in the visions of Daniel, chapter 7 through 12. On the one hand, the visions themselves say that they refer to the latter time. Now stop. If that's what they say, then what do they mean? That they refer to the latter time. Now, that's God's way through Daniel of addressing some particular time frame. Does that mean necessarily that I know what latter time God is referencing there? No, I might have to do some study and thinking about this, to figure out latter times of what? Is it the latter time of Edom or the latter time, of Egypt, the latter time of these nations that are falling one after the other in this 100 years we've been talking about? Is it that latter time, of a nation? Or is it the latter time of the planet? Now, ask me, do I think one day the planet's going to be rolled up like a garment and done away?
Yes, I do. Okay. Of course I do. I can find that in the Old Testament and quote it again in the New, Hebrews, for instance. So, you know, I have no doubt about that. What I do have some objections to is what the vast majority of the religious world does every time they come across in their Bible, Old Testament or New, the phrase, last days, last time, latter days, or latter day, or the various ways that those expressions are translated in the Old Testament or the New. Is it correct to just assume that every time God uses the expression last days, that he has to be talking about the end of planet Earth and the wrapping up of the whole universe? No! And frequently that term is used when in the passage it tells you what nation or city or people last days he's talking about. And we have the historical verification both in the Bible and out that those nations came to their latter days and they don't exist anymore. How many Edomites do you know? Not too many. And they were mentioned, of course, in Jeremiah's prophecies in this reading. So, now, let's come back to this paragraph. A second chronological difficulty has to do with identifying the times referred to in the visions of Daniel chapter 7 through 12. On the one hand, the visions themselves say they refer to the latter time, 8:19. They're even today very often interpreted as referring to events that have not yet occurred, which is a dreadful mistake, and almost laughably silly that anybody would make that mistake. We'll get there. It wasn't in this week's reading. It's just abundantly plain that that's not what they're doing, but people do make that mistake. On the other hand, the more explicit visions in chapters 10, 11, and 12 quite clearly refer to the end of the Persian Empire and the rise of the Greek Empire of the 4th through the 2nd centuries. See Daniel and the Greeks in Daniel 10. Yes, they certainly do. And there's absolutely no mistake there. So why should there be any question earlier when he's talking about the same thing? But what we're looking at in these paragraphs is people disagreeing about how to understand what the prophecy says. And the editor's walking on both sides of the fence there. But they said it right the first time. When you have corroborating evidence that is just manifestly plain elsewhere in the book, and then you're looking at some other passage that you think is a little more obscure, should you be understanding the plain passage in the light of the obscure one, or the other way around? The other way around. Typically, the way we refer to this is, let the Bible interpret the Bible. See, and that's what we'll be doing here. And it's really not that tough. Now, one last paragraph, and then we'll talk about why it is so tough. So, last paragraph there in that column. To say that Daniel's vision speaks specifically of events in the Persian-Greek period does not, however, mean that they cannot also refer to the latter time. Now, brethren, that's, you know, that's sleight of hand there. What are they assuming in that sentence about the term latter time? That is referring to the end of the world. It's not. But in this sentence, they're assuming that. And so, since they're making an assumption about how to understand that term, they've misunderstood it in the passage, and they're actually defending an idea that we'll talk about in just a moment, then they need to fix it. They need to figure out a way to have it both ways. So they say, to say that Daniel's vision speaks specifically of events in the Persian-Greek period does not, however, mean they cannot also refer to the latter time. So what are they proposing here? You read one sentence in Daniel. How are you supposed to understand it? Two different ways separated by centuries and maybe millenniums. Brothers, where else do you do this in the Scripture? Why would anybody do that? How can you know if a prophecy is fulfilled if it means more than one thing, and the two things are hundreds or even a millennium apart? That's craziness. God is not double-minded, nor does he double-speak. Okay? So you need to be maybe a little more involved in your Bible study, maybe a little more, you know, strong in your faith, maybe just have a little bit more courage to say, you know what? I think it means this and not that. Because usually, brethren, when somebody starts arguing, well, you see that passage? That can mean two totally different things separated by hundreds of years. Usually what they're saying is, I haven't got a clue what he's talking about. Here are the two possibilities, and I can't pick between them, so I'm going to say both are equally valid. Brethren, what if God does not think they're equally valid? What if God intended for them to be understood one way? Just because you don't know what that way is, does not mean that God said it's okay to believe both or whatever else you want. No. I think it's perfectly acceptable to say, you know, I don't think I understand this passage yet. I don't grant that it's a very good idea to just say it can be understood two totally different ways, so let everybody have it the way they want. Now, I will grant that on occasion, and with contextual and other passage help, so that there really isn't any mistake, there are a very few passages that God uses in more than one way. Talked about those before, not going to get into it again tonight. Very few, very plain, because God wants you to understand, and he'll give you the information so you can understand if he's using a passage that way. When he doesn't, let's not just start glibly speaking for God about what he's allowing that in this passage he never said a word about. So that's really overstepping the bounds in my view. Admit you don't know what you're talking about, but don't suggest to speak for God that, you know, it can mean more than one thing and everybody's right. Then he continues, Daniel's visions are densely packed with obscure and surprising images. They resist being restricted to any single meaning. Well, is that right? Really? Now you're speaking for both God and Daniel about how he's resisting being understood. Well, I doubt it. For this reason, many scholars understand them to have multiple fulfillments. Quite a few actually aren't satisfied with only two. Thus, Daniel 7 through 12 can be read in light of historical events at the end of the first millennium BC, while keeping in mind the possible references to an ultimate fulfillment. See the apocalyptic visions of Daniel at Daniel 7:1. That, by the way, very top of the right-hand column is on page 1060. So if you want to make that note, flip over there, it's page 1060. So, I know I spend a lot of time on this, it's fine. I have very little I want to say about Jeremiah. I have just enough time to cover what I want to do with Daniel tonight. That's the nature of this particular reading. So, what do we have there? We have one of the poorer transitions in the book. These are Bible-believing men. I'm not saying they're stupid. I'm not saying that they're, you know, hypocritical. I'm not saying they're dishonest. I'm just saying they look to me like they're just trying to satisfy everybody. God wants you to understand your Bible. Walking away from a passage, not knowing what it means, and inventing multiple meanings and saying everybody's okay, not a good idea. Now, I promise you, we talk about why that whole transition exists. That transition exists because there's been several attempts throughout the centuries, but really successful ones in the 1800s and 1900s, to teach a system of last days called premillennialism. Somebody want to give me a definition of premillennialism? Pre means before. Millennial means 1,000 years. And to be very facetious from an old-time preacher among us, ism means it just ain't so. Premillennialism. That's funny, but ism, of course, means system or understanding group of ideas. Premillennialism is the theory that there's a literal 1,000 years in which Jesus will literally leave heaven, and in the literal flesh, he will literally have a temple built in the literal Jerusalem from which he will reign for a literal 1,000 years. That's not 999, it's not 1,001. And in that period of time, he will be reigning through the millennium. He will come back pre the millennium. Premillennialism, in American ignorance, gained prominence as the most popular understanding of how God was going to wrap up the world. It just ain't so. And it is one of the most pathetic and indefensible things you've ever seen. And as a matter of fact, after enormous popularity, rising up to a pinnacle thanks to the Left Behind books. All remember the Left Behind craze. Okay? Hugely popular. Many millions of books were sold. Movies were made about this. And that was the height of premillennial popularity in our lifetime, not very many years ago at all. You all remember it. Since then, that theory has suffered so many failures, setbacks, and controversy among themselves. They've got at least four different opposite kinds of premillennialism. They're all arguing among themselves, and their numerous traditions have failed time and time and time again. So that premillennialism, brethren, to my great delight, has peaked and is declining in American history now. Not so happy about the fact that all things biblical is also declining in popularity, you know, at the same time. And I attribute something of the decline in biblical confidence to the rise and fall of premillennialism. Because it became abundantly plain that the most popular eschatological, that means last time, system in America and the world was an utter failure. And so, the skeptics appear to be right. Those who supported that silliness had egg all over their faces and had to regroup, and they're fleeing for the hills now. And it really reflected bad on whom? God and his book. Because these people in his name had totally misrepresented what the Bible taught on this subject, particularly in Daniel. And when it all failed and clearly did and they couldn't defend it anymore, then the skeptics had a heyday, biblical confidence took a dive. They certainly play a role, I'm sure, in what is becoming, you know, the rapid decline, you know, of biblical confidence today. That was their failure, not God's, not the Bible's. So, this whole paragraph here, this whole transition, brethren, is about premillennialism without ever naming it. It's about the failure of premillennialism without ever naming it. It's about the confusion of premillennialists who see the failure of their doctrine and don't know what to replace it with because they can't figure out what Daniel was talking about. That is their failure in their study and understanding, not God's, not the Bible's. Okay? So then, that brings us to Daniel. Now, let me go rather rapidly here because we talked about it on Sunday night and you're all familiar with it, and the straightforward history here is marvelously encouraging, but we don't need to review what I'm quite sure everybody here knows. All we know about it is found in Daniel 1, and the chapter is absolutely true, every word of it. So there's a marvelous story about three teenagers, apparently, standing up against Nebuchadnezzar himself with their lives at stake to believe their God, even if the scholars think differently. Okay? Daniel chapter 2, however, is that profoundly important chapter that we talked about. So you saw this artist illustration again on Sunday night, but I didn't talk about it a whole lot. Daniel chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar had a dream in the night. He saw something like that. It scared him to death. He wanted to know what it was that had happened, and he wanted to test the soothsayers over here, you know, eating chicken guts. You know, if they knew what they were talking about. So he said, I need somebody to tell me what I dreamed as well as what it means. Nobody could do that except whom? Daniel. So Daniel interprets the dream in chapter 2. In the dream, he says, Nebuchadnezzar, what you saw was this figure of some kind, very impressive, frightening even to look at. There's a head of gold. There's a breast and arms of silver. We have this bronze center part, you know, that's the belly and the thighs. And then we have this iron mixed with clay, legs and feet at the bottom. What do these things represent? Now, if you go online as I did, you can find all kinds of charts like this. And brethren, everybody knows, and there's just really so little disagreement as to be none. Well, after all, Daniel interprets the dream. He says, who is the head of gold and what does the head of gold represent? You, Nebuchadnezzar, are the head of gold and it represents the Babylonian Empire. After you, the passage says, there will be a second empire, not as good as you. That will be what empire? Medo-Persia. Who defeated the Babylonians in 539 B.C.? Medo-Persia. After them, Daniel interprets the dream, there will be a third kingdom. Remember, he is defining them numerically. Number one, number two, what's number three? Number three is Greece. It unfolds in biblical history and in world history exactly as Daniel says in chapter 2. He's telling the story hundreds of years in advance, and yet it takes place exactly like he said. The interpretation beginning in Daniel 2 and at verse 36, if you want to turn over to 743 in right-hand column. But I'm totally leaning on your having read this passage. It's one of the most famous in biblical knowledge, and certainly you read it this week or 100 times before. So, what is named, the fourth kingdom? What is the last kingdom? It will be Rome. So look carefully at this chart, because I cheated. That's not the original chart. The original chart looked like this. Now what did they do? Originally they said, well, there's five parts. Never mind that fifth never appears in the passage. The fourth kingdom is all integrated, and the pronouns would all require that there's only four. So, it is the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire is represented by the legs and the what? The feet. That's all Roman Empire. And then as the passage unfolds, the feet is the what part of the statue? The weakest part. When it gets struck by the stone cut out without hands, what happens not just to the feet, but to everything? He says, in the days of those kings, this whole thing's going to be destroyed. What are the last kings that are ever being discussed? Rome. But they imagine a fifth. The fifth, according to the chart right here, this is the companion chart from the same people, goes like this. Okay, head of gold, Babylon, they did the dates. Breast and arms of silver, Medo-Persia, they did the dates. Everybody agrees. Belly and thighs of brass and Greece, there's the dates. Everybody agrees. Legs and feet of iron and clay, Rome. They give the dates. Problem is I cheated again. That's not what they did. They said legs of iron, Rome. Then they put feet of iron and clay, papal Rome, and modern nations of Europe, 476 AD to the second advent, by which they mean the end of the world. This is premillennialism, which has failed so badly in many of its aspects that it's now just declining in popularity. People finally are giving up on it. We've been fighting it for 150 years, but finally people are giving up on it. So I wish they'd been satisfied, but they weren't. They think that this fifth kingdom is a resurrected Rome in the form of Roman Catholicism. The two having only the name Rome in common, and not one biblical passage to sustain it. Now I've got to get up on my high horse again. So here's the page from my Bible that I hate. It's the worst one in the whole book. I love the book. But the total premillennialists, and so they put this chart together. Prophetic overview of Daniel. Daniel 2, Daniel 7, Daniel 8, Daniel 9, Daniel 11 through 12. You can't read it. It would have been a fabulous chart. The vast majority of it is dead on accurate. It's only until we get down here. I want you to know. Head, arms, thighs, legs, and then what? Big gap. Suddenly down here, totally disconnected. What do you get?
The feet. Okay. Now, here's a close-up again on this. So what we have, just looking at Daniel 2 and not comparing it to the other passages, is, a little closer on that. Going to zoom in again. So now you can see they got Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, they got Rome. Everything's going just great. And then what do? You can't see it because I zoomed in just this half. But right over here on the original page were these words.
gap of time. A gap of time, by the way, which is going to run, they think, for 2,000 years. It's a big gap. Okay? Now, you all read Daniel 2 many times before this week and again this week. Where do you remember reading about the gap in time? Where do you remember reading about how the whole body was floating way up above the feet, way down there, you know, separated from the feet? How many of you read anything like that? How many of you ever read about a fifth kingdom in Daniel 2? There's just absolutely no such thing. This is what they should have done. They should have not decided to support premillennialism, their preconceived erroneous notion that they had to build in 2,000-year hole to make it work. They should have just accepted in the days of the Roman kings these things would take place, which is what happened in history. And I couldn't leave well enough alone, so I went and got another one.
Here they turn the statue sideways. They get it right, they get it right, they get it right, they get it right. And then what's this? The church age. A 2,000-year gap between the ankles and the feet. Where do you read about any of that in Daniel? You just don't. And it's the biggest period of time by far in the whole progression of succeeding kingdoms. What reason is there for that?
None! Except what you read in the transition, where many scholars think that this is really deep stuff. And so we're going to posit that you can understand these things two different ways. And when you do, well, then clearly, to make it worse, you've got to insert 2,000 years of nothingness between the feet and the legs. Let's be not treating our Bibles like that.
I noticed that on the second chart that they told you exactly where it was in the Bible.
No, not hardly. Not hardly. So, let me just summarize right here. You read Daniel 2. The entire chapter is about one event. There's the event, and then there's the interpretation of the event. And when you're reading about this thing, is there any such separation? No. Does everybody agree historically that one kingdom followed after the other, just like Daniel interpreted it? Yes, that's exactly what we understand. So, when the passage says, now we need to go find this, everybody come on over to Daniel 2 on page 743, and we'll just read through it, the whole interpretation, so you can see it. Maybe I should have done it earlier. But here's, starting in verse 36, Daniel 2, right-hand column on 743, first full paragraph. This is the dream. Now, we will tell the interpretation of it before the king. You, O king, are a king of kings. For the God of heaven has given you a kingdom, power, strength, and glory, and wherever the children of men dwell, or the beasts of the field, and the birds of the heavens, he's given them into your hand. He has made you ruler over them all. You are this head of gold. Then he says, but after you shall arise another kingdom inferior to yours. Then another, a what kingdom? A third kingdom of bronze which shall rule over all the earth. And the what kingdom? The fourth kingdom shall be as strong as iron, inasmuch as iron breaks in pieces and shatters everything. And like iron that crushes, that kingdom will break in pieces and crush all others, which certainly was wrong. Whereas you saw the feet and toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, the kingdom. Does that say the fifth kingdom? Does that say the next kingdom? Does it, like the previous ones, tell you whether it's inferior or greater? It says the kingdom. What's the only kingdom we're talking about here? The fourth kingdom. It says, whereas you saw the feet and toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, the kingdom shall be divided. Yet the strength of the iron shall be in it, just as you saw the iron mixed with ceramic clay. What were the legs made out of? Iron. Just as the toes of the feet, verse 42, are partly of iron and partly of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly fragile. What kingdom? The kingdom. The fourth kingdom. As you saw iron mixed with ceramic clay, they will mingle with the seed of men, but they will not adhere to one another, just as iron does not mix with clay. And in the days of these kings,
The ones he's talking about, one after the other, Rome at the bottom. In the days of these kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed. The kingdom shall not be left to another people. It shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. Inasmuch as you saw that the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, that it broke in pieces the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold, the great God has made known to the king what will come to pass after this. The dream is certain, the interpretation is sure, and in the top of the next page, the Nebuchadnezzar says, you're just absolutely right. And then I think the society said, by the way, Daniel, I don't believe those scholars either. Okay. Now, you know, I don't know. That's their chart, not mine. I didn't even try to decide. I saw it too, and I said, enough of that. I don't know what they're claiming here. All right. What do we have? We have four kingdoms. In the days of those kings, a stone, a great stone, cut out without hands, going to come down and strike the statue. Does it strike the head of gold? No. Does it strike the arms, silver? No, strike the hips. What does it hit? The feet, which are iron from the leg, mixed with clay in what is called the fourth kingdom. Then, what happens to all of that statue? The whole thing is obliterated. And we are told, let me go back to this other one. Okay, we are told that this is because there will be a fifth kingdom. That kingdom is going to destroy what? All of this. How many Babylonians do you know? That kingdom did not endure. How many Medo-Persians do you know? Aren't any, long gone. How many Greeks do you know? Well, I know one that's in Athens right now. He was born and raised there. He owns an apartment there. He's there right now. Good long friend of mine since 1975. Is he a part of Alexander the Great's kingdom? I'm not saying the country's vanished off the map. I'm saying that the kingdoms are gone. What happened to Rome? They're suggesting in 476 BC. What happened? It's gone. Are there Romans today? Well, sure. Is there a Roman Empire today? Is the Roman Catholic Church it? What's happening to Roman Catholicism right now? Just plummeting. You think premillennialism's having a hard time? Take a look at Roman Catholicism. So, in the days of those kings of a fourth empire, which everybody knows is Rome, unless you want to add 2,000 years and a fifth kingdom, in the days of those kings, what did God do? He established a kingdom that what? Will destroy and outlast all of these. It will be, therefore, of a different kind, type, or nature. It is a what kingdom as opposed to those? A spiritual kingdom. When the Medes and Persians conquered Babylon, did they get some people from Babylon? Did they get some gold and wealth from Babylon? Did they get some castles and buildings, you know, from Babylon? Yeah, sure they did. Can anybody do that with Christianity? Can you destroy it to begin with? Can you conquer it? Has it not outlasted all of these by a factor about 4 or 5 to 1? You betcha. What he's saying is, when God cuts out a stone without hands, it's not a physical kind of a kingdom. And the prophecy is fulfilled precisely as Daniel said, if you're not too smart for your own britches. So he, declined to invent 2,000-year gaps to try to fit preconceived notions that just don't hold water anywhere else in Scripture, let alone in Daniel. So, a lot of time on Daniel 2. Be confident in Daniel 2, brethren. Be very confident. Because there was a time when you suggested what I just suggested, people just laugh at you because they all knew that Jesus was coming back any day now to go live in a temple in Jerusalem. Okay? That was the popular thing. And they were selling millions of books to spread that lie. But it all failed and just kept collapsing. Jehovah's Witnesses had preached that. They said 1975, that didn't work. They've been declining ever since. Seventh-day Adventists have predicted it time and time again. They failed time and time again. And so, one after the other, a lot of different religious groups, held to this. When it all was failing in their date calling, now it's being abandoned. And glad of it.
what has always been the same in our understanding of Daniel 2, in our understanding. How many kingdoms are in the book? Four. In the days of which king will all these things take place? The fourth. A new kingdom's going to be set up. When John the Baptist appeared on the scene, brethren, what was he preaching? Repent, for a couple of thousand years from now, the kingdom's coming. Remember that? He had to talk about the gas first, didn't he? Oh, he said the kingdom is what? It's near. It's at hand. The fifth kingdom was close. Okay? Did the God of our fathers set up an eternal kingdom that can never be destroyed? Do any of these other kingdoms still exist? No. And if you read Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, does it count if I listen to it on tapes? Can I say I read it? All right, I read it. Okay. And it's great if you get way late, you know, hundreds of years after, you know, the period of Christ. It's not so good anymore. But anyway, if you do go ahead and read Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, or whether on tape or not, he, you know, is renowned, one of the world's greatest scholars and historians. That book is just revered. It's a colossal work. It's hardly got a peer. And in there, he details how it was that Christianity put an end to the Roman Empire and all that it had inherited from the Greeks, the Medo-Persians, and the Babylonians before it, and how things were never the same again on earth after Jesus set up the kingdom in the days of those kings that you belong to. To the work, to the work.